Okay, both sides ready? All right, if you call the case, please, we'll get started.
The court will now call John Kyle Kramer versus Weir SPM. May it please the court, Mr. Ernest Reynolds will argue for the appellant. Mr. Mike Weir will argue for the appellee.
Okay, Skip, you ready?
Leaves the court, counsel, and my client is here. He's come up from San Antonio, but obviously he's sitting back in the gallery. The first thing I'd like to do is point out that in our reply brief we have some spelling errors that we noticed, and we apologize for these. And one of them is particularly embarrassing because on page small two, down there under statement of facts at B, we say appellant's brief misstates fact. And that should have been appellee's. And that occurs again, I think, at page six, at page seven, in the fourth line, saying that the court must be help to follow. That should have been held to follow. And then on page two, first word in line five, should have been no as opposed to not. And I apologize, and I'll take full responsibility for all of those errors. I'm sure that in context, everything probably made sense. This is a case that was tried to the court one afternoon in December of last year in county court at law. After that, the court signed a judgment giving no reasons. The case turns primarily on rules 296 and 297 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. Apparently, an argument is interposed that a local rule, Rule 303, could somehow trump the state rules. In my time on the Court Rules Committee, which was about 6 years, we used to get something like this about once a year. I have to say I was the most ignorant person on the committee, but all the judges and all the professors seemed to always say, well, obviously state rules can't be trumped by local rules, and I think that is the law. So we've included a statute here, which is our tab 12, the government code, section 22004, and it tells the way that a rule can be made under notice and comment rulemaking. Gives that power only to the Supreme Court. And in our reply brief, we have also noted, in particular at pages 14 and 15, I think, that there is also case law on this point. For example, the Beach case from the Dallas Court of Appeals. But basically, the notion is the Supreme Court makes the rules and other courts can't remake them. There may have been some confusion because in a case that is tried to the county court at law or any trial court to the jury, the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure clearly provide that you probably are going to give jury charge materials to the judge who will evaluate them during the trial. I'm sure Judge McCoy did that many times on the bench. The local rule also says that, but the rules 296 and 297 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure deal with the situation where you don't have a jury. Rule 303, however, seems to contemplate making proposals for findings of fact. This is local rule 303, and conclusions of law even before the trial. Well, what happened here was we had the trial, we had the judgment, and it comes before you in the appellee's brief as their exhibit one. It's very brief, and it was drawn by the judge himself and signed. And it just says someone wins and someone loses. So we don't have any fact determination. We don't have any point of law. We had multiple theories of liability. We've got the petition here. And we also have, that's our tab two in our original brief. We have the second amended answer. These were the trial pleadings. So there are several theories of liability. There are several theories of defense. And some of the case law that we've cited indicates that in this situation, if you make a timely request, as we did, for findings of fact and conclusions of law, and you don't get them, harm is presumed because you're confused. And that's what happened here. And briefly, we filed on a timely basis a request under Rule 296 for findings and conclusions. The trial court had 20 days. He didn't make the findings and conclusions, perhaps because it was the holiday period, perhaps because he was busy. We then timely filed under Rule 297 the notice that these findings were tardy. That gave the trial judge an additional 20 days. So now he had 40 days from the date of his judgment, and the last day was on or about 30 January of this year. He still did not make any findings or conclusions. The other side had proposed some findings before the trial started, but after the trial, they never made any request for findings or conclusions until we got to the point where we were about to run out of time and we had to either walk away from this or give notice of appeal. So as I recall, the last day was a Monday, and I think the preceding Thursday we gave notice, and the next day we requested some record materials, realizing that we didn't know what to ask for except for some clerk record materials, and brought this forward. And at that point, opposing counsel sent a letter to the trial judge and basically said, hey, why don't you make some findings? We gave you something before trial. To which I filed a response, which is significant because it is now argued that the response somehow waived our right to appeal, and it appears as Appendix 3 to the appellee's brief. But if you'll look at it, what I was trying to do was say, Judge, wait a second. I think these folks are trying to draw you into error. At the end, in the last paragraph, it says, I strenuously object on behalf of the plaintiff to having actions taken that are not proper, taken in proper ways through proper proceedings in connection with proper hearings, proper and timely filed motions. Because what had happened is, by this point in time, we'd gotten all the way through. The judge no longer had the power under the applicable rules to make findings or conclusions. Furthermore, we had gotten up on appeal, and we were actually on appeal after the time when we could not have lodged an appeal, and 62 days late, the judge of the trial court then signed off on the findings and conclusions that had been given to him prior to trial by the other side. And at that point, we're in a real pickle because we've had to appeal. We didn't know what the findings might or might not be. We didn't know what record to bring forward. So I would submit that given what's happened, this case should be reversed and sent back to the trial court because the trial court failed to follow Rules 296 and 297, not through failure of Appellant to try to invoke the rules, but for whatever reason, the trial court didn't do that. And we ended up in a situation where we didn't know what was on his mind. It reminds me of what we were taught by Professor Elliott, later Dean Elliott, in procedure class. And he pointed out, you make these requests for findings under the rules, and the trial judges hate them because it is difficult for them to unravel, but there's no other way that you can complete that portion of the record which you need to know what the judge was thinking, and that's what you have to know in order to be in a position to assess, first of all, whether or not to appeal, and second, on what basis and what part of the record might you need. So that's why we're here. It's a fairly straightforward thing, and I think it's probably best summarized in the reply brief, which incorporates the appellant's brief as to statement of facts. But at page 1 and 2 and on through page 4, there's a statement of the case, and it includes a reference to Smith versus the Weber Company. That's the Dallas case that I mentioned to you, and that case appears at Appendix 4 to Appalach Brief, Smith versus the Weber Company. And that's the case that says at Head Note 2, the general rule is that an appellant, that would be us here, has been harmed if, under the circumstances of the case, he has to guess at the reason the trial court ruled against him, which is exactly where we were. The case then continues and says in part, when there are two or more possible grounds of recovery or defense, and in this case, it's here today, there were two or more possible grounds of recovery or defense. It says, when there are two or more possible grounds of recovery or defense, an appellant is forced to guess what the trial court found unless the trial court's findings are provided to him, which they were not, and we didn't have them, would not have had them at the time when we had to make the decision about whether to appeal or not. So we appealed. I would say, for what it's worth, that we think that we have a decent and fair case, a meritorious case on the merits, or we wouldn't be here arguing about a procedure point. But the merits are not before the court today. This is here on procedural questions.
Well, speaking of procedure, the usual procedure when a trial court fails to timely file findings of fact and requests and conclusions of law, and a notice, even based on a notice of past due findings of fact and conclusions of law, is for us to abate the appeal and send it back to the trial court for them to do so. And so I'm wondering what relief you're requesting, because you have findings of fact and conclusions of law now at this point, albeit, as you have pointed out, late.
Well, but the problem here, and it's kind of like the problem that occurred in the case at tab 4, the Smith and Weber case, is that there's an unusual procedural wrinkle here. There the wrinkle was that there was a new elected judge, and under the statute they had to send the case back because the judge who had tried the case had not become dead or disqualified as defined under the statute. Here the problem is we had to mount the appeal without knowing what the judge had done, and so we don't have a reporter record, and the other side's going to say, well, we ordered it and they didn't want it. I've got a guy here who worked and earned a year's salary and then was deprived of a bonus. That's what this case is about. That's why part of the brief says the trial judge failed to understand the law of God and man. Christ himself said, as recorded in the Bible, to the worker his wage, and Texas law recognizes this ancient rule of common law. So that's what this case is about, a guy who's got about $16,000 or $17,000 of wages and is out working now for this lumberjay company and does not have the money to buy a record he may not need. If you send this back under an abatement, then we don't have the opportunity to get a record. So if the judge fails to decide in the favor of my client at that point, holds a hearing presumably, but fails to do that, unless there's something in your ruling that says that at that point we can define issues because now we know what the judge has decided and we can bring forward a record, we're caught in a box not of our making.
May it please the court, counsel. The issue on appeal is whether the trial court's belated findings of fact and conclusions of law that were filed 3 months before plaintiff's opening brief was due, whether that constitutes reversible error that mandates retrial of this case. The Fort Worth Court of Appeals has answered this question in Morrison versus Cogdell. Specifically, in Morrison, the trial court had filed findings of fact and conclusions of law after the notice of appeal was filed and after the record was compiled. The appellant in that case sought reversal because the findings of fact and conclusions of law were not filed in accordance with the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. The Fort Worth Court of Appeals held, quote, "The trial court's failure to comply with this duty is remedied, however, by the filing of the requested findings and conclusions while the case is on appeal," end quote. The Fort Worth Court of Appeals went on to state, quote, "In this case, the trial court has filed findings of fact and conclusions of law in a supplemental clerk's record. Therefore, Morrison's complaint is moot," end quote. In reaching this decision, the Fort Worth Court of Appeals cited the Cherney Industry versus Magellan's case. That's a Texas Supreme Court case from 1989. In that case, the Texas Supreme Court found that even though the trial court in that case had completely failed to file findings of fact and conclusions of law, the proper relief in that instance, and this is according to the Supreme Court, was to, quote, "direct the trial court to file findings and conclusions in compliance with Cherney's request," end quote. In reaching this holding, the Supreme Court cited the predecessor to the current rule of appellate procedure 44.4, which in pertinent part says that if the trial court makes a mistake and it is, and you can remedy it, then it should go back to the trial court for remedy, that reversal is not the appropriate relief. Accordingly, plaintiff's argument that belated findings and conclusions warrant reversal and a new trial, that is contrary to both Fort Worth Court of Appeals precedent and Texas Supreme Court precedent. Plaintiff's brief makes another related argument. Plaintiff cites two cases for the proposition that there is presumed harm by belated findings. Yet the case law directly contradicts plaintiff's argument in this case. First, plaintiff cites the case of Randall v. Jennings. That's a Court of Appeals case from Houston, 14th District. And they cite that for the proposition that belated findings are presumed harmful to the appellant. Your Honors, in Zebia versus Martin, which is cited in our brief, the Houston 14th Court of Appeals reversed Randall. The Zebia court stated, quote, "In Cherney Industries, the Supreme Court implicitly overruled previous decisions of this court holding that reversed and remand is a proper remedy for the trial court's failure to make findings and conclusions." The court then specifically cited Randall, the case that plaintiffs rely on in their appellate brief, as an example of a case that has been implicitly overruled by the Supreme Court. Second, and this was mentioned during counsel's argument, plaintiffs cite Larry F. Smith, Inc. v. Weber Company. That's a Dallas Court of Appeals case from 2003. And they cite that for the proposition, in their brief at least, that reversing a final judgment is proper when the trial court fails to enter findings of fact and conclusions of law. Yet that case did not involve belated findings. That case involved a case where there were no findings at all. The court never entered findings. In any event, the Dallas Court of Appeals in that case held, and they stated specifically, the preferred remedy was not to reverse, but to abate the appeal to give the trial court the opportunity to enter findings of fact and conclusions of law. However, the Dallas Appellate Court determined that abatement wouldn't work under the very specific facts of that case. And those specific facts were that in the interim, the district judge had been voted off the bench, and he was no longer on the bench. And it was only that fact that led them to conclude that abatement was not an option. Thus, the Smith case has absolutely no bearing on the current appeal, in which undeniably findings of fact and conclusions of law have been entered by the sitting trial judge. So plaintiff's presumed harm argument doesn't work. Now, to the extent plaintiff is now trying to claim he was actually harmed by belated findings, this point is waived because it was not presented in the appellate brief. In any event, where SPM's brief cites well-settled case law showing that plaintiff could not establish harm from the belated findings and conclusions of law. For example, a Dallas Court of Appeals case, In Re EAC. 14 days in that case, 14 days after appellant filed her notice of appeal, the trial court issued findings of fact and conclusions of law. The Dallas Court of Appeals held, quote, when a trial court files belated findings, the only issue that arises is whether the appellant was harmed, not whether the trial court had jurisdiction to make the findings. And the court went on to say there are two types of potential harm. One, the litigant is unable to request additional findings of fact, or two, the litigant was prevented from improperly presenting his appeal. Yet in that case, the court found that the appellant had failed to establish harm because he did not request additional findings from the trial court. He did not ask the appellate court to abate the appeal to allow the trial court to consider additional findings. And the court made the observation that the findings and conclusions were entered well before the appellate brief was due.
What about motions for new trial?
Pardon?
How do you file a motion for new trial if you don't know what the findings and conclusions are?
Well, Your Honor, there was a motion for new trial filed in this case.
Well, but isn't that another area of harm? If there are no findings and conclusions, it makes it difficult to file a motion for new trial that makes any sense. So isn't that something else that should be considered? The briefing, as far as you know, the brief goes, but also the ability to file a motion for new trial, because in civil law, sometimes that's necessary to preserve issues for appeal. Shouldn't you throw that in as one of the considerations, harm considerations?
And Your Honor, I guess in the particular facts of this case, a motion for new trial was filed well before, or I believe was filed before the findings of fact deadline had run. And in fact, the court, when it sent the belated findings, as this is in our appendix, when the court sent the belated findings, he wrote a cover letter, and in the cover letter he said that the reason why he had held off was because he had assumed that there was going to be a hearing on plaintiff's motion for a new trial, and he wanted to hear that motion before he ruled on, he made the findings of fact and conclusions of law. And the hearing was never set. And then the court, when they did not set the hearing, at that point, the court entered the belated findings and cited the Cherney case, which is the Supreme Court case, and the Zubia case, which were the cases that show that a court can enter belated findings. So in the present case, Your Honor, the plaintiff did not request additional findings or conclusions from the trial court. Plaintiff did not ask the trial court to abate anything so that additional findings could be made. He didn't ask this court to abate the appeal so that the trial court could consider additional findings. He didn't ask this court to abate the appeal so that if he wanted to file a revised motion for new trial, he would have had that opportunity. And the trial court entered the findings in this case over 3 months before the appellate brief was due. Therefore, even though plaintiff has not raised these questions, he's waived these issues on appeal because he hasn't raised them in his appellate brief, the case law shows that there would be no harm. Indeed, as set forth in both the Robles case, which is a Houston Court of Appeals case, and the Hardy case, which is from the Austin Court of Appeals, they're both cited in our brief, plaintiff's failure to request additional findings or to request abatement from the appellate court so that the trial court could conduct new things like enter additional findings or, to Your Honor's point, to consider a different motion for new trial. Because that relief wasn't requested, the right to even complain of harm was waived on appeal. So based on the clear case law, Your Honor, plaintiff cannot show that he is entitled to any appellate relief based on the trial court's entry of belated findings of fact and conclusions of law 3 months before his opening brief was due. And we're SPM asked the court to affirm the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you. Skip.
I don't have much time, but I've made notes and I'll try to be efficient. First of all, I'm not sure that several of these points were raised in any briefing by Oppoli, but Oppoli was on notice that we claimed harm, responded to it, and then we responded. For example, at page 20 of Oppoli's brief, we discussed the fact that there was harm and that it was presumed. with citation. Now, I'd like to go through these points rather quickly. This business about, well, my gosh, there were findings 3 months before the brief ignores the fact that there were not findings until after we had to make the election to appeal. Second, this discussion of the Smith case and the fact that it had unusual circumstances is then used to argue that it doesn't match up with this case because our unusual circumstances are different. But it does, because it was the unusual circumstance in the Smith case that led to the appellate remedy, and here we have a different set of unusual circumstances. Mr. Bierer said that we had not made any claim of harm in our brief, and I think I've noted at page 20, for example, we did. Then Mr. Bierer says, well, we didn't ask for additional findings. And I would ask all of you, but in particular, I would ask Judge McCoy, who's been on the trial bench, this question. How do you ask for additional findings and conclusions during the period allowed to you to elect about whether or not to appeal when you have done everything permissible under Rules 296 and 297, and we did, and there are absolutely no findings? You have exhausted the remedies available to you under the rules at that point. We followed the rules. We exhausted the remedies. We made our request timely under 296, 297. There were no findings, and there were still no findings on the very last day when we could have appealed, and we didn't appeal early. Now, as for the motion for new trial, Justice Doffino, I think you're right on the point there. We filed one, but it was meaningless. And we tried to say you got the wrong result, but we had no notion of where the court was going, so there was no way to have a meaningful hearing on it. There's one other thing here. We all like the trial judge and respect him. That's not the point. But what the trial judge did was to take a bunch of findings that were given to him in a letter from the defense attorneys before there was ever any evidence. It's an ill-fitting shoe. This is just a case where the rules were not properly followed by the trial judge in a way that gave us any right at all to do more than what we did. We followed Rule 296, and we followed Rule 297. And it's a case where the result deprives us of any meaningful remedy except to come here and ask for a remand and a new trial, or in the alternative, a remand that tells the trial judge to hold a hearing and gives us a right to supplement the record if, based on findings and conclusions, that becomes appropriate.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument. The case is submitted. Appreciate you making the long trip here. What we do isn't all that exciting, but it is very helpful to us, so we appreciate your coming in. We will be in recess until 3:00. You're free to go about your business, or if you want to hang around and watch the next case, you're welcome to do that.